Hey folks, Tony and I are really excited to continue our partnership with Ruiz Auto Services, All American Used Cars and Trucks. We got some great new specials here for Ruiz Auto, located at just south of 90th and Fort here in Omaha, 4839 North 90th Street. Just talked to Esmeralda the other night, and here's what we got for the next couple of months here. Saturdays, if you are looking for a free inspection and check on your air conditioning, all you have to do is say a pen and a napkin sent you in, and the crew at Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust will check your air conditioning. They will inspect it, and it will be for free. Also, on Saturdays, while you're there, you need an oil change, right? Just it's a Saturday ritual, especially in the summertime. Go in and get your oil change. If you mention a pen and a napkin, it'll be $50 for your oil change, start to finish there at Ruiz. If you're in the market for a new set of tires, mention a pen and a napkin here over the next month or two, and the crew at Ruiz will give you a free mounting and balancing on your new set of four tires. That's a great deal, because that's probably, gosh, that's got to be a good $100 at least for the mounting and the balancing on the new tires. Just mention a pen and a napkin, and they're going to give that to you. So Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, All American Used Cars and Trucks, Esmeralda and Juan Carlos have been terrific to a pen and a napkin. They want to be terrific for you as well. They do great work, and I think you should check them out. So please go check out Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. If you're in the market for a used car, All American Used Cars and Trucks. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 138. And we are going to do something new this week, and we are going to do something new with someone new. Tony is on vacation. Him and Rita had grandparents camp this week, and so they are out. I think he's going out to Indianapolis. I think they might be catching a fever game or two, something like that. So, Tony, have a great time, buddy. Hope you and Rita enjoy some downtime before the school year gets going. So, I needed a guest host with me this week because I know folks didn't want to listen to my nasally Italian voice solo. So I looked high, I really looked low, and the lower I looked, I found the perfect person to help me out this week. I'm just kidding, Jim. That's a joke. I hope you know that. So Jim Simons, the head boys basketball coach at Westside High School here in Omaha. Jim, welcome to your guest appearance here on the coaching staff.
Well, thank you. That was quite the welcome, and you would certainly probably find some people to agree that you had to look pretty low and probably pretty deep into the bullpen. But happy to be here and have listened to you and Tony many times. So I'll do my best. The bullpen arms usually aren't quite as good as the top line starters, but hopefully you didn't dig too low here.
Well, why don't you think of yourself more as like Goose Gossage or Raleigh Fingers? You're going to come in and you're going to seal the deal here.
To be the closer.
You're going to bring the heat from the get-go. So, Jim agreed to help me out this week. And not only is he helping me out, but we are going to broach something totally new and so totally different. So a little backstory. You're always thinking of different ways of doing things. You don't want to tip the apple cart too much. If it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. But just like in coaching, you want to do some, you want to experiment a little bit. You want to tinker. And Tony and I were together at Snow Valley, and I'd had this idea brewing for about a week or so. And I wanted to kind of break it to Tony and see what he thought. And it took us about 8 seconds to say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do this. So what Jim and I are going to do today, what Tony and I are going to do, the first podcast, the first coaching staff of every month, is we are going to talk about the influence of a great coach in the game. And so the first name that Tony brought up was John Thompson. He's like, oh, so like somebody like John Thompson. I'm like, hey, yeah, sounds good. Let's do John Thompson on the first one here. And this is a little bit different. So shameless plug, but it's my podcast. I can do what I want to do. In Hoops 365, which will be coming out here in the next 6 or 7 weeks, hopefully, there is about 10 coaches that I recommend that any coach of any level study. And so we are not going to put those coaches here, at least for the foreseeable future, into this podcast, because there's stuff about them in the Hoops 365 book. So those coaches, just to give you a little bit of an idea, Don Meyer, Rick Pitino, Pat Summitt, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, John Wooden, Phil Jackson, Gino Auriemma, Tara Vanderveer, and Bob Hurley Sr. Now, none of those are quite Jim Simons, but they're awful, awful good basketball coaches.
I was kind of wondering if I would make that top 10. I must have been 11, huh?
You were 13th.
All right. Yeah. It must have been 11 and 12 must have been pretty good.
A sandwich between John Thompson and Tom Crable. So
if I'm only one below Tom Crable, I'll certainly take that.
Okay. But so I'm going to leave that for the book. And so if you want to know some of my thoughts on those coaches, here's the simple solution. You buy Hoops 365 when it comes out here. So obviously there's so many other great, great coaches in the game that you can analyze and look at. And we will, over the span of however long Tony and I keep this going, that's what we're going to do here. So that was kind of the original thought with this. And Jim and I are going to get that going here today. But before we jump into John Thompson, we, of course, have to talk a little basketball history. Mr. Simons, do you know who the 1954 NBA champions were?
I do not know who the 1954 NBA champions were.
Okay. It was.
Did you give me any clues?
This franchise is no longer located. It's still a current franchise, but they are no longer located where they won the championship in 54.
How about the Lakers?
You are correct. Or let me give you, I got to give you everything that I give Tony. I'll give you the Marv Albert here.
Yes, and it counts. Jim Simons from the baseline.
They beat the Syracuse Nationals 4-3 in the 1954 NBA championship. They added a player that year. George Mikan was kind of at the end of his career. They added a guy who we talked about, Tony and I talked about a couple weeks ago, Clyde Lavallette from Kansas University. Here's a little fun fact for you about Clyde Lavallette, Jim. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
He is the first player in basketball history to win an NCAA championship, an Olympic gold medal, and an NBA championship.
It's got to still be a pretty select members of that club, I would imagine.
Yes, that would be an interesting dig to find out how many players fit that criteria. Because like you said, it would not be a very long list, I would not imagine. So this also, the last little tidbit I have on this was the last championship for the Lakers until 1972. So this is their last championship in Minneapolis. They don't see another championship until the early 70s. And then, of course, we hit the 80s and we know what happened there. So how about this, Jim? 1954 NCAA tournament champions.
Going to have to give me another clue on that one.
From the city of brotherly love. This is where this university is located.
Okay, so Philadelphia. How about LaSalle?
Yes, and it counts. Yeah. He's on fire. Absolutely awesome.
Tony's job might be in jeopardy, huh?
You're not using AI for this, are you?
No, I'm not. I promise I'm not. I'm yeah. Well trained in it, but I'm not using it.
Tony right now is looking up Wally Pipp. LaSalle over Bradley University, the Braves, 92-76. The best player for the Explorers was a guy named Tom Gola, a future Basketball Hall of Famer. According to my Wikipedia research, he was the Magic Johnson of his day, averaged 23 points and 23 rebounds a game this in the 54 season. So, you know, and he could guard 1 through 5, I guess 6'8", versatile. that type of guy. So Tom Gola was the best player for the Explorers. Well, I won't give it away for next week because we have to worry about next week. So there's your champions there. Well done, Mr. Simons.
Yeah, not bad. A couple good clues on your part. And when you had Philadelphia, I knew LaSalle had won one at one point. I don't remember. I don't think Temple had won one. And mm-hmm. obviously Villanova's were later. So mm-hmm. your clues were good.
Oh, thank you very much. So let's talk a little John Thompson here. Kind of a forgotten name in the pantheon of great coaches, but without a doubt, he deserves mentioning. So we've got some categories here that, and this is something that we're thinking. And by the way, please, I forgot to mention this. Opinions, good, bad, otherwise, if you have one as we go through this, tell me what you think of this concept, of this idea. And if you think it's good, please let me know. If you think it stinks, by all means, please let me know. We don't want to waste anybody's time, but I think it's a fascinating topic. And we'll just start here, Jim, just kind of at the overall. I think it's important to go back and study great coaches, know where we came from, pick up on the things that are tried and true in the game, and have an idea out of respect for the game to know where they came from.
Well, I think no doubt. I think, you know, all of us who have coached, probably have said over and over, I mean, basketball is a game that can be played and coached successfully in so many different ways. You know, I always give our players the example. I'm a big Duke fan, and, you know, for years under Coach K, Duke was a, you know, on the line, up the line, almost entirely man defensive team. And, you know, when Virginia won it 5-6 years ago with Coach Bennett, you know, entirely pack line man defense, you got two very successful coaches, both have won national championships at the Division I level, who would probably completely disagree on, you know, 80 to 90% of their man defensive tenets. And, you know, so I think going back in and kind of remembering, like you said, some of these coaches who have been really successful, even if there's some things, you know, that maybe have changed about the game over the last 20, 30 years, or there's some things that maybe don't apply to your team or your situation, there's probably a nugget here or there. And for many of these coaches, several nuggets that everybody can pick up. So I think it's always good to, you know, study people, especially those people who have been really successful. Mm-hmm. And he was obviously, you know, as we'll get into, I mean, successful, I think, not only on the court and the on-court results speak for themselves, but very successful in the role he played in the lives of his players, which I think for most, if not all, the people who are probably listening to your podcast, I mean, if they're dedicated to their coaching enough to be, you know, tuning into podcasts and trying to make themselves better, I think we all aspire to do more than just teach kids how to, you know, put this ball into the basket and score points. It's to help kids as they kind of grow throughout their life, whether you're coaching them at the middle school, the high school, or the collegiate level. And mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt that, you know, the coach we're going to talk about today was very impactful in that regard.
Well, safe to say, Jim, if you want to, you know, there's transactional and there's transformational coaches. Most coaches want to be transformational. If you want to be a transformational coach, it's hard not to look at John Thompson and say, study that guy.
Absolutely. I mean, just the impact, you know, I know we'll get into it, but the impact he made, you know, in the lives of his individual players, the impact he made on Georgetown University as a school, you know, and I think you can look at many other African-American head coaches and assistant coaches who would point to, you know, him as a role model and a leader. And, you know, so the impact, I mean, he was transformational in many ways, you know, for his players, for his school, university, for other coaches. And, yeah, I think, like you said, anytime you're talking about transformational coaches, he's right at the top of the list in terms of the things that he did off the court, along with winning a lot of games on the court.
Yeah. Well, without John Thompson, there is no Nolan Richardson, probably, or I don't want to say probably, but it makes it harder. There is no Tubby Smith, you know, I mean, he broke down so many barriers and he learned from, you know, some of the best. Just, you know, we'll just give a quick bio on Coach Thompson here. He went to Archbishop Carroll High School in Washington, D.C. He was a Parade All-American. went to Providence College, and Providence was a pretty big time program back in the 60s and the 70s. I think it was like 70, 71 or 72. They played for an NCAA championship, got beat as most everybody did at that time by Wooden's UCLA program. But they won the 63 NIT championship, 64. They made it to the NCAA tournament when it was a lot harder to make the NCAA tournament than it is today, because the tournament was much smaller. He left Providence as the all-time leading scorer in the history of the school. He was drafted by the Celtics. So you're talking about the social consciousness. He served as Bill Russell's backup for 2 years. And, you know, Bill Russell has legendary stories about Bill Russell, his social consciousness, his fight against racism, the awful things that happened to him as a human being while he was in Boston. So he, you know, Thompson learned a lot from him. I thought it was interesting. He was drafted by the Bulls in the 66 expansion draft, but he didn't want to relocate to Chicago. So he retired after 2 years in the NBA. We'd never see that happen today.
No, you would not.
So, he coached 6 years of high school ball at St. Anthony's High School in Washington, D.C. He was hired by Georgetown in 1972. Interesting couple of names that he beat out for the job. I thought this was real interesting, Jim. George Raveling and Morgan Wooten. So he's swimming with some pretty big fish there, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and obviously Morgan Wooten, another wildly successful high school coach. You see how the times have changed. So you have, which I know we'll get into, Georgetown, which was not the program or the stature that it is now, but still a Division I program. And two of the three finalists were local Washington, D.C. area high school coaches. My guess is when the Georgetown job comes open the next time, they probably two of the three finalists will not be. And there's probably some very good high school coaches in Washington, D.C., but they may not make it into the final three of that. But that's kind of an interesting tidbit there, though. And obviously, you know, Coach Wooten stayed at the
DeMatha for a long time. Yeah.
And that ended up, you know, that ended up working out pretty good for him. And obviously, Georgetown made a heck of a decision and, you know, to hire Coach Thompson and what he did for the university. And, yep. And George Raveling ended up being pretty successful as well. So they had three pretty good finalists. I think doing my research, I saw the year before Coach Thompson got the job, Georgetown was 3-23 or 3-25. So, yep. Those are three pretty good finalists to take a job for a team that was 3-25 the year before.
Yes. And Thompson did a heck of a job of turning it around. 3-23. Yeah, like you said, the year before. 3 years later, he had him in the NCAA tournament. And this is the tournament had expanded by this point, but I think it was still only at the most like 32 teams, if that.
Yeah, and you had to win your conference to get in. I mean, there were no at-large or very few at-large bids at that point in time.
Yeah, so he was at Georgetown 27 years. 596 wins. At one point, took him to the NCAA tournament 14 straight years from 1979 to 1992. So just, you know, really an incredible journey for John Thompson as a coach and getting to this pantheon and establishing, you know, the 1980s. And maybe I'm jumping the gun here a little bit on this. Let's hold off on that. Let's talk about his coaching style. You know, what were his teams known for? What did you what made Georgetown such a great team and made Thompson such a great coach, Jim?
Well, I think the one thing that stands out, you know, as you and I were talking off air before we got on, is obviously a lineage of very talented post players. You know, Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, I think Othello Harrington played there. And
don't forget about Mutombo.
Dikembe Mutombo, you know, so they just had, it just seemed like, you know, and you remember watching Georgetown back in the, you know, the mid to late 80s, early 90s, and they just always had a very dominant, very intimidating post presence. And, you know, defensively, you know, I think his teams were built on, you know, knowing that they were going to have that 7-foot, 7-foot-1 shot blocker, you know, intimidator at the rim, and, you know, a lot of them to be very aggressive on the perimeter. And, Georgetown was, they were the epitome of maybe 1980s, early 90s, grinded out team. I mean, they were going to be tough. They were going to guard you. They were going to really get after you on the perimeter. And if you were able to get it in the paint, you were going to have to deal with, you know, somebody who was an all league or potentially an NBA all league, NBA Hall of Fame, post player in there. So I think that obviously, during the 1980s when they had their most dominant run was just that run of very, very good post players, mm-hmm. Late 80s, early 90s. And then obviously, towards the end of his career, Allen Iverson, which, didn't fit the bill of a dominant post player, the other end of the spectrum, an elite point guard, which again shows probably his versatility as a coach. Some of those, 1980s, early 1990s teams dominated by a post player, and then Allen Iverson comes along, and you've got a jet quick point guard who's kind of very ball dominant, but obviously very successful there. So I think those are things that on the court his teams were known for, and just the toughness, and they kind of brought an intimidating presence with them. I think Coach Thompson was a large man himself, 6'10", as you said. He was a former NBA five man, and I think he made no bones about it. He his size, and they wanted to, you were going to feel their presence and his presence if you were playing Georgetown.
Yeah. It wasn't a complicated formula from a schematic point of view. And again, Jim, and you and I are seasoned and experienced enough to have watched these teams play in our formative years. Maybe me more so, a little bit more so than you, because I think I got you by a few years.
You do. Yep. Yeah. I would have been coming of age in the 1980s and, but certainly the latter half of the 80s and early 90s, I was pretty tuned in as a youngster to watching basketball. And like you said, I don't think Coach Thompson made any bones about it. It wasn't, overly complicated schematically. It was playing very hard and being very good defensively, being very good on the boards, and then playing through your best player offensively, whether it was one of those, several all NBA type, post players he had, or Allen Iverson. I think there's something to be learned for that from coaches of, if you can get your guys to play really hard, and, obviously it helps if you've got some of the levels of players that he did, but, you just kind of trust your better players. And, he kept it very simple, but very, very successful.
It's early August, folks, and you know what that means. It means it is time to go back to school, and just like you, I'm not terribly excited about it either, but I am excited about the start of the 2025 Metro Basketball Coaches Association Coaches Clinics. Coaches, if you are within a 30-mile radius of Omaha, there's no reason why you shouldn't sign up for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Coaches Clinic. We've got a great lineup of coaches this fall. It is very much worth your while. Let's go through the lineup here. We've got 4 Wednesday nights, 2 in September, 2 in October, September 17th and 24th, October the 1st, and October the 8th. We've got Division I assistant coaches. We've got coaches in waiting. We've got great high school coaches. Let's run through it here. September 17th, Brian Cooley, the University of Minnesota's men's assistant. He is going to do both sessions. He's coming down from Minneapolis, and he is going to give us a bunch of really, really good stuff there. On September 24th, we're going to have 2 speakers. My lifelong friend, Dick Jungers, the head girls basketball coach at Newell Fonda High School in Iowa. Wonder how he got on the docket. But yes, reached out to Dick. He is going to come down September 24th. He's going to do the first hour. And then Alan Huss, the associate head coach at Creighton University, essentially Coach Mack's coach in waiting, highly successful coach at High Point in North Carolina. He's coming back here to Omaha. He is going to be our second speaker that evening. On October the 1st, we've got Mark Krueger, my good friend Krugs. You've heard Krugs on the podcast numerous times. He is going to be speaking, as well as Nate Lenzer, the assistant assistant coach at Nebraska with the men's program. Coach Lenzer, a great, great basketball mind. I've known Coach Lenzer for a few years. He's going to do a bang-up job on October the 1st. And then October the 8th, we are going to have Jamie Carey, the new Omaha women's head coach. She is going to do both sessions that evening. She's going to use her staff as well. Those first three nights, September 17th, September 24th, and October the 1st, those are going to take place at Legends Sports Bar, located at 6920 Pacific Street here in Omaha. On October the 8th, we are going to go on the court at Brownell Talbot here in Omaha. The doors open every week at 6 o'clock. There's going to be beverages. There's going to be chicken wings. That goes from 6 to 7. And then the speakers start at 7 o'clock. We're going to have door prizes, a lot of really, really good stuff. Here's the deal. If you register before September the 1st, $75 per coach on your staff. So you divide that. That's less than $10 an hour for your coaches to come in and get great, great knowledge and have the opportunity to network with coaches in the area. After September the 1st, it's going to jump up to $90. So if you want to sign up four of your coaches, or let's say yourself and three of your coaches, that's a $60 savings by getting signed up by September the 1st. If you are interested in registering, send the registration to Ralston High School. Attention, Mr. Tom Crable, K-R-E-H-B-I-E-L, 8969 Park Drive, Ralston, Nebraska, 68127. Make your checks payable to MBCA. Coaches in the Omaha area, again, 30-mile radius. There's no reason not to sign up for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association 2025 Coaches Clinics. I would say, yes, here's the formula. We're going to play tough as you know what defense. We're going to be tougher than you. We are going to intimidate you before you even, because of that, our reputation preceded the, you know, and their reputation preceded them before they even stepped into the gymnasium. You knew exactly what you were going to get. Their identity was clear as a whistle. Full court pressure defense. He's going to throw 9 or 10 guys at you, and they are just going to wear you down over the span of 40 minutes. And would it be fair to say, Jim, for folks that are not as familiar with this, kind of, you know, to give a modern example of at least this style of play, would be what Kelvin Sampson has done the last 5 to 7 years or so with the University of Houston. You know, we're gonna just defend, toughness, strong, big, deep. We're going to run waves at you, and we're going to be just good enough on offense to be competent enough that we're going to win the game. And I think as you were talking about that, that's what popped into my head. What do you think of that comparison?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you said a lot of things. And then I think the only thing I would add is both teams, both the Houston teams of the last few years and certainly the Georgetown teams during Coach Thompson's run, borderline dominant on the boards, along with the toughness defensively and kind of the pressure that they're going to put you under, both on the offensive and defensive boards. Just a huge emphasis placed on rebounding, and I think the size and the physicality of both of their teams showed on the boards. And to beat them, you were going to have to be really tough with the ball, be really sure with the ball and crisp in your offensive actions, and then you have to be really physical, to handle both their physicality as they're guarding you, and you're going to have to be really physical and box them out and go rebound. And it's, it's certainly a formula that, maybe isn't the sexiest formula. Probably neither team is going to be involved in a lot of, 103 to 100 type games, but it's a winning formula. And it's a formula that, quite honestly, a lot of teams don't enjoy playing against. And which makes it an effective formula, because people know they're against either team, they're gonna have to come prepared for a fight. You're gonna have to really fight to beat them, and you're probably gonna have to knock them out to beat them, because they're both coaches are known for just tenacious teams that that aren't gonna quit and aren't gonna go away.
Yeah, I think the phrase I would use: they're not going to lose to you. You're going to have to beat them.
You're going to have to knock them out.
Yeah. That's I think that's a heck of a compliment. If you look at somebody, you know, that's the perception that you have of their program and the way that they play. I would take that as a tremendous compliment if somebody said that about my team. Hey, we know you're not going to lose to us. We're going to have to beat you. And I think that's a great mentality for you to have as a coach, as you prepare your team for each game, for each upcoming season, et cetera. So, greatest successes. I really think, obviously, John Thompson was a trailblazer. He was the first Black men's basketball coach to take a team to the Final Four back in 1982, on the brink of winning a national championship in that same Final Four. That was the same year where, what's the guy's name that threw it to James?
Fred Brown.
Fred Brown. Fred Brown. Yep. Threw it to James Worthy after some guy named Jordan hit a 17-foot jump shot from the wing. But he's the first.
Only not to interrupt you, Marty, but we talked earlier about this. Transformational coaches, that play, but also the image of Coach Thompson with his arm
around him. Yeah,
I mean, that, you know, that's just an enduring image from a game that was over 40 years ago. And that image, you just have seen it, you know, not only the mistake, but just the coach's reaction in the, you know, the most critical of, you know, of time in a national championship game. I mean, just a great example of his transformational value as a coach.
Yes, absolutely. A couple of years later, he comes back. He is the first Black head coach to win a national championship in 1984, defeated the University of Houston up in Seattle. I still remember that game plain as day. It was the matchup of Elijah Wan and Ewing. 1999 Basketball Hall of Fame inductee, maybe the greatest achievement of Thompson's career. 97% of his players graduated. And he was, you know, before this, Georgetown, it still is an elite academic university. It's in the Big East today. It's got a great law school, very similar to what we have in town here with Creighton. So he was recruiting a lot of kids who were not used to that academic environment, and yet 97% of his players graduated with a degree. Most of his players, unless they, you know, Patrick Ewing stayed for 4 years. Alonzo Mourning stayed for 4 years. And that's a little bit more of the norm during that time period. But, you know, it was surprising to see Ewing come back for his senior year. It was surprising to see Mourning come back for his senior year. So, you know, his influence, you know, obviously a winning coach, did a lot of great things in that regard, but you know, that is such a the way he set up a lot of young men for success beyond college is so many ways. It's so important for what we do, and most of the folks that listen to this are high school coaches. You know, yes, it would be great to see this kid to get this scholarship to wherever, but he's probably not going to make a living playing basketball. What am I doing to help set him up so he'll be successful in college, so he'll get that degree, so he can be a productive member of the community? And I think, you know, those championships, those trailblazing achievements on the floor were extremely noteworthy.
No question. I mean, you rattled off, obviously, a very impressive resume and a reason why he was inducted into the, you know, college basketball or the Basketball Hall of Fame. And the winning, especially when you know, like you said, those of us who were around in the 80s and the 90s, I mean, Georgetown, especially that run in the mid 80s, was the dominant program in college basketball. You know, you talked about 82, they were a turnover away from winning the championship. They won the championship in 84, 85. They, you know, one of the bigger upsets of all time when Villanova, you know, beat them. But, you know, they could have won three national championships in a 4-year span. Yeah. I mean, they were essentially a play or two away in 82 from winning it. And, you know, they were probably the better team in Villanova in 85. And I probably know probably about it. They were, and we've all been there before. Sometimes, you know, Villanova shot the heck out of the ball that game and played, you know, what a lot of people characterized as kind of the perfect game to beat them. But, you know, there's an alternate world out there where they win 3 out of 4 national championships, and you know, from a university that had essentially no basketball history prior to John Thompson becoming the head coach. You know, as we referenced earlier, 3-23 the year before he got the job, and that wasn't a 1-year downturn. I mean, it was just a university that was known as a very strong and rigorous academic institution that that didn't have much of a basketball program. So,
I think 1943 had been the last time they had qualified for the NCAA tournament. Was 43
years prior to him getting it. So yeah, I mean, just you know, the on-court success just tremendous. But I think the stuff you talked about that, you know, most of the folks listening to this as high school coaches, are the impact that he had on his players' lives. And yeah, he had really, really talented players, probably more talented than most of the high school coaches are going to have. But the 97% graduation rate for guys who stayed 4 years is, you know, is just tremendous. I mean, you have to be tremendous at any university, but to do it at an academic institution like Georgetown, where, you know, I don't think underwater basket weaving is the aforementioned Coach Crable likes to, you know, reference that degree. I don't think that's on the agenda at Georgetown.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and he was known for, you know, taking a chance on some kids that were maybe borderline in terms of their academic qualifications for a university like Georgetown. And, you know, credit to the kids who obviously did the work in the classroom, but the structure that was put into place for his program, you know, anybody can get lucky for a year, right, and have a bunch of good kids and they all graduate. But for over the course of you know, a long career like
three
he
decades.
Had to have a 97% graduation rate, obviously that, you know, the program and the expectations and the standards that were placed on the players as student athletes, you know, was clear. I mean, that proves it out there. I mean, that number is very high, and you know, that doesn't happen if there's not clear standards and expectations, and also probably a lot of support for the student athletes to ensure they're being successful both in basketball and also in their academics and managing their time and all those things that kids need as they transition from high school to college. And, you know, the fact that that was that important to him, as important as, you know, winning, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of games that he won, I think speaks to the type of leader that he was. You know, there's an anecdote that I think most people have probably heard that he, you know, he kept a deflated basketball on his desk anytime a player would come meet with him in his office to remind the player that at some point the ball will stop bouncing. And, you know, for a guy like, you know, Ewing and Mourning and Iverson has stopped bouncing later than for others and after making a lot of money. But, you know, the point being that he was trying to prepare these kids for adulthood and trying to take young men and turn them into men and men who were able to be successful either as professional basketball players, as some of those guys were in roles other than basketball, you know, as the deflated ball showed when the ball stopped bouncing. And I just think, you know, deserves a ton of credit for that. College athletics, right, were a different time then than they were now. You referenced it. I mean, it's very rare for players of that level to stay 4 years today. And that was probably really a time where college coaches had an opportunity to be really transformational in their leadership. And he obviously took full advantage of that and just did a tremendous job. And not only the on-court responsibilities, but also the off-court stuff and, you know, countless players, you know, both when he retired and then when he passed, just the kind of the tributes and the testimony that so many of his former players gave to not only the impact that he had on their basketball career, but the impact he had on their life. You know, I think all of us as coaches, you know, you would hope when we retire and are no longer here that that there are players that speak of all of us the way his former players speak of him.
Mm-hmm. We're in this game long enough. We do this job long enough. Jim, you know just as well as I do, we're going to have great successes, but then there's going to be a couple of failures along the way. And you know, we gotta keep it balanced here. I had two big ones that John Thompson will be associated with, unfortunately, in his career. We'll take them in chronological order. You had referenced it. The 1985 NCAA championship, you know, they're on the brink. I distinctly remember watching this game. John Thompson is tied into two of the most the two games that permanently changed the way we look and observe and coach the game of basketball. 85, they played Villanova. Now, again, if you go back and watch the 30 for 30s and things like that on the history of this game, you know, Villanova is obviously from the Big East as well. They had played Georgetown. They had the advantage of playing Georgetown a couple of times during the season, and they had played them tough. They had lost by, you know, I think, 5 or 6 points both times that they had played them, but they had played them enough times that they weren't intimidated by them. And like we had talked about, that physical presence, that intimidating defense that they brought to the table. Villanova was not a newbie to this. They were used to it. They knew what to expect. Nonetheless, they go out and they play what many coaches refer to as the perfect game. They shoot 78% for the game, and they end up upsetting Georgetown. It was 63-61 or 65-62 or some number like that, and they win the national championship. A lot of people consider it to be the greatest upset in the history of college basketball. It's ironically, it is the last Division I men's game that was ever played without a shot clock or a three-point line, Jim. Did you know that?
I did not know that. That's,
yeah.
Probably without a shot clock, maybe makes the upset a little bit easier, but without the three-point line, you know, because obviously the three-point shot in today's game can be a great equalizer, makes the upset maybe even more impressive that they were able to do it without the, you know, ability to, you know, I always say if somebody's going to hit, you know, 14, 15 threes, you got a chance to beat a lot of people. So the fact that they did it without the three-point shot makes the upset even more impressive.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people would see that as a great failure. I mean, your thoughts on that, Jim, real quick.
Well, I think, yeah, Georgetown was the better team. You know, I don't think they're, you know, I think even probably Rolly Massimino and the Villanova people would acknowledge that. I mean, Georgetown was the better team. It's part of what, you know, and we haven't talked about it, but I'm guessing the next game you're going to talk about is maybe when Princeton beat them or almost beat them.
No, it's actually not. But
okay. Yeah. But, you know, people always talk about the beauty of the NCAA tournament, right, is it's a one and done. I mean, if it was a best of five or a best of seven, as the NBA is set up, Georgetown highly likely wins that series. So part of it's what makes the NCAA tournament the NCAA tournament, and in high school basketball, for a lot of us, it's what makes a high school basketball postseason you know, so exciting, is you don't have to be better than somebody over the course of a season or over the course of 5 or 7 games. You got to be better than somebody in a high school game for 32 minutes and in the college game, obviously, for 40 minutes. And, you know, so I think, yeah, but it was obviously a difficult loss for Georgetown. But, you know, and then I think you give the credit to Villanova there. Their shooting percentage, you referenced it. I know it was unbelievably high, but we've probably all at some point in our coaching career, just not on the stage of the national championship game, have been in a game where, you know, you felt you had the better team. And basketball a lot of times comes down to being a make-miss game. And sometimes you just run into a team on a certain night where they're you know, yeah, you probably could do some things better defensively, you know, maybe could have followed your game plan a little bit better, been a little more locked into the details. But sometimes the other guys just make shots. It doesn't happen at, you know, that high of a level of shot making that often that Villanova did that night, especially against a defensive team like Georgetown with the interior presence they had to alter and you know, kind of impact shots at the rim. But you know, I think instead of looking at, you know, obviously, like I said, tough loss, but to me, it's more credit to Villanova and the beauty of March Madness in a one-game deal. And you do it long enough, you hope it's not in a championship game, but you're going to run into a night where the other team, you know, they just make a bunch of tough shots and you get beat. And, you know, I think that would be my take on that game, was more of a credit to Villanova for throwing the perfect game, you know, as opposed to Georgetown, you know, getting beat. I mean, you know, it took Villanova shooting, what'd you say it was, 70-some percent?
78, I believe is what it was, yeah. Harold Jensen went nuts.
You know, and they beat them by a bucket.
Yep.
You know, and they shot 78% from the field. And I do agree with what you said, and you will run into this at all levels, that I think, you know, the more times you can play an opponent that's better than you, if it's somebody you're going to have to play in the postseason, I do believe it's advantageous, you know, because you can, you know, at the high school level, maybe it's not the size and physicality of those, you know, mid-80s Georgetown teams. But, you know, there's been some teams, you know, like in the Omaha Metro in Class A, you know, Omaha Central, Bellevue West, over the years that have really pressured you with their speed, with their athleticism, with their ability in the full court, and to have played that a time or two, you know, I think it's always advantageous. And, and I have no question that that helped Villanova, and, you know, Georgetown would have probably been better off certainly playing somebody not from the Big East who wasn't quite as familiar with their style of play and the physicality that they're going to bring to the game.
Yep. Any other failures that you had, Jim, before I get into my second one, which I have a much childhood basketball trauma childhood that I still have a bit of a bone to pick.
I mean, am I remembering right that they lost Princeton?
They almost lost. It was like 50-49.
Okay. They won by 1 point. Okay. I believe it was a 116 game.
Yeah.
So I guess it wasn't a failure. But I remember, you know, you talk about childhood memories. I think that was in maybe like the 89 or 90 NCAA tournament, somewhere in there.
Right around there, yeah.
And I would have been 12, 13, 14 years old. And that was back before, you know, today, obviously every game in the tournament is easily accessible, whether it's TV or live stream. But I distinctly remember watching that game, and at halftime, Princeton had a, you know, a decent lead on them. And it was just shocking, you know, and to the point where I couldn't quite remember if they, but now that you say it, yeah, they won by 1 point. So other failings of John Thompson.
You want me to just jump into it?
Yep, I do.
All right. Okay. And I want this to come across the right way, because I understand the pressure, and I don't, because obviously I'll never be under that amount of pressure. But the 1988 Olympic team, and it's not
that's right. They got the bronze medal.
It's not that they lost to the Soviets, because the Soviets were loaded. They were loaded. They had Arvydas Sabonis before he tore two Achilles and, you know, had vodka, you know, consumed a lot of vodka. And they're playing against grown men. But that team, and John Thompson was at the point, and Bobby Knight did this largely in 1984. He kind of set the precedent where, if I'm going to be the coach, I'm going to select the team. And John Thompson kind of did the same thing. What we failed to do, the failure to adapt, was to the international game and the emphasis of the three-point line. We had no shooting. Steve Kerr, Sean Elliott, Rex Chapman, these are all guys that could have been on the team that were cut. We replaced them with Charles Smith and Bimbo Coles, who are much better at basketball than I'll ever be. However, they did not fit. And when we, now we still had David Robinson, we still had Danny Manning, obviously two tremendous players. Danny Manning, one of those shoulda, coulda, woulda careers. But, you know, I still remember Dan Marley was our leading scorer, because he shot it every time he touched it, it felt like. You know, so now, you know, the 85 game against Villanova, it's significant, like I said, for the shot clock and the NCAA, or for the shot clock and the three-point line. Obviously, this was the decision where we said, okay, if you're going to play pros, we're going to start sending our pros, which leads to the dream team. So, you know, John Thompson is at these two massive pivot points of basketball history and the way we observe it, the way we construct teams, the way we think of basketball today. But even at the time, I was like, God, this team feels like it should be better than what it is. And, you know, that's it's unfortunate. You know, it's unfortunate that it was a preventable mistake that we had there.
Well, and it, you know, it goes to speak to, you know, I think the importance of roster construction. And, you know, I think another thing was at that point in time, you know, it was a new coach every year, every Olympic cycle, and a coach that, you know, quite honestly, not only for John Thompson, but probably every coach the Americans had, not overly experienced in the international game. I know, you know, as many of my friends, coworkers know, I'm a big Duke fan, so it makes me a big Coach K guy by default. And, you know, he was very open about, you know, when he took the national team job, I think it was in 06 at the World Championships, you know, they lost, and I think in the semifinals. And he was very open and said, I didn't know what I was doing in the international game, you know, and then I, you know, that was a huge you know, aha, or, you know, got to keep it PG-13. So, sure. Oh, you know, do you know what moment for him, Reed, just be acknowledged. I was out coached because I was used to coaching the American college game. And I figured out very quickly after that 06 World Championships that if I'm going to do this, I need to know and learn the international game. And, you know, so I think to me, it's as much of a systematic failure of, okay, you're putting this college coach in, you know, you referenced it, the 3-point line comes about after the 85 tournament. So in 86, you know, so you're talking about the 88 Olympics and you have a college coach who's, you know, for the vast majority of his career up to that point is playing with no 3-point line,
yep,
who built his teams around, an elite post player, you know, and now all of a sudden you get into the international game where the 3-point line is more prevalent. You've got post players who are maybe stepping out and maybe a little bit more,
yep,
you know, face up type post player. It's a different game. And, you know, there's no question you can look back now with, you know, the benefit of hindsight being 2020 and say, yeah, the roster construction, there were some errors that were made, but, you know, I would say he probably put a team together that was in the likeness of his Georgetown teams in, you know, 1984 and 1985. And you kind of know what you know as a coach, and that's a style he was comfortable coaching. And, you know, so I think, you know, the first change, obviously, that the United States makes as a result of the 88 failure is, okay, we're going to send the pros. And obviously in 92, 96, and 2000, the United States is so much better talent-wise than the other countries that just sending the pros, it's, you know, gold medal and it's blowouts and, you know, but then by the time 04 runs around, you know, the United States realizes, okay, just sending the pros isn't good enough. And I think that leads to, you know, Jerry Colangelo,
yep,
you know, kind of, you know, becoming the, you know, director of USA basketball and Coach K becoming the senior national team head coach and more kind of an organized top down approach. So I think those are both, you know, kind of pivotal moments in, you know, international USA basketball. But I obviously the roster, you know, construction was not perfect, and it was sure stunning. I mean, I was 11 or 12 years old, but I remember that, you know, I mean, U.S. always won in basketball. The only time they didn't win was in 72, when most people would tell you, well, there were some, there was some extreme irregularities at the end of the 72 game. You know, so it was stunning that the U.S. got beaten basketball. And now that you say it, you do remember John Thompson taking brunt of the criticism, essentially being the first American coach to lose legitimately in the Olympics. And like you said, with hindsight, we can clearly see roster construction and, you know, kind of maybe adapting to the international game. But like I said, I would, in defense of Coach Thompson, say, well, maybe, you know, the USA basketball at the time, you know, pegging coaches with very little international experience and just coaching the Olympic team. You know, I think now, you know, they're at least in a cycle where they coach, you know, kind of the world championships and then the Olympics, and then they cycle in a new coach, you know, where you at least you get some experience coaching the international game prior to the high stakes of the Olympics.
Yep. Yep. Interesting facts about Coach Thompson here, Jim. We mentioned a couple of them already. Two number one overall draft picks, Patrick Ewing and Allen Iverson. Both of them were number one. Mourning, I believe, was number two overall for Charlotte. Walked off the court in 1989. He was upset by something called Proposition 42. This was preceded, for those of you that need a little history lesson, this was preceded by something called Proposition 48, where this is where if a player didn't get like an 18 on the ACT, they were ineligible for their freshman year, had to get their grades up. A lot of, you know, Thompson led the charge against this because a lot of these kids coming from schools who did not prepare their kids well for standardized testing struggled on the standardized test, et cetera, et cetera. And then Proposition 42 was another layer to that. So he walked off the floor before a game against Boston College in protest of this, which, like you said, Jim, force some things to get changed with that. So we
talked about standing for what you believe in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, he He walked off the court and let his assistant coach that game. I believe he maybe missed one game after that. If I remember correctly, that he maybe missed two games in taking, something bigger than the game, right? I mean, yeah. He felt that not just Georgetown kids, but a lot of kids were unfairly, impacted by this Proposition 42. And he believed there needed to be national attention to it. And while a lot of other coaches were agreeing with him and speaking out, their thoughts about the unfairness of the rule in their mind, he was the one that really showed the brightest light on it, because you have one of the most influential, most successful coaches in the country at that time, walking off the court very dramatically at the start of the game. And then it did bring a lot of attention to it, and the NCAA did modify the rule. But I think just another look at the impact he had beyond just the game itself, and the fact that he was willing to miss a game, or two, speaks volumes.
Yeah, and he had the gravitas to do that at the time. He could do it and probably get away with it more so than the average coach. But he had earned that reputation. He had earned the privilege to be able to do that and not face the same scrutiny as maybe some other, even though he did face some scrutiny. There were some people that didn't like it, but a lot of people understood where he was coming from as well.
Yep. So. And it was like two conference games. It's kind of one thing to do it in a non-conference bye game against, South Carolina State, where you're going to probably win by 40. I mean, two conference games. I just think, like you said, there were certainly people who disagreed, and maybe some other coaches without his track record who couldn't have got away with it. But the fact that he knew he could do this and it would shine light on an injustice that he felt, to me, is an important part of his legacy.
Mm-hmm. A couple other things here I found interesting. Obviously, he defended his players. He looked out for them. Did you read the story about him confronting the drug lord in D.C. Over his?
I did.
Yeah. So
when I did talk about a little courage there, I guess, obviously, Coach Thompson was an intimidating man himself, but kind of stare down face to face, kind of a well-known D.C. drug lord in the 1980s when that, was obviously, a big thing. I mean, that took some courage.
Yes. Rafel Edmund III, he was this drug dealing, ran a gang. I read somewhere where he alleged was involved in 40 plus murders or something. And he kind of, as people do, kind of worked his way into the program, had befriended Alonzo Mourning and a couple of other players. And John Thompson called him into his office and he basically said, "Stay the blank away from my players." And the guy backed down, which there's a lot of shady people out there that try to get their talents into young and talented people. And John Thompson said, "This is not happening." And I thought that was a pretty crazy story. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
No, and that, again, just falls right in line with what we talked about a lot today. I mean, he was certainly took his role as a mentor to his players very seriously. And just another example of the steps he was willing to go. It would have been very easy to, act oblivious to, what was going on outside of a basketball practice. I'm sure this drug lord wasn't showing up at Georgetown practices or games. It was obviously going on away from basketball. It would have been very easy to ignore it or to act oblivious. But, as the story goes, once, he kind of got credible information passed along to him that this guy was infiltrating some of his most talented players, Coach Thompson knew that if there wasn't, some sort of change there, this could go in a very bad direction for some players that had a very bright future. And, the easy thing would have been to let it go. But, obviously somebody who cares about his players and his future and their futures, willing to do that hard thing that took courage.
Mm-hmm. The last thing that I found was interesting fact. He was supposed to be on Flight 77 on September 11th.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah. I think he was supposed to go like on the Jim Rome show and he canceled his flight at the last minute or whatever, or the producer on the show told him to cancel the flight for some scheduling reason. And, fate kept him alive for another almost 20 years.
I did not know that. That is that's quite a fact.
Mm-hmm. Coaching today is, let's be honest, it's harder than it ever has been. And the demands on us, the things that coaches are asked to do, the lengths that we are supposed to go to be the best coach that we can be, it's becoming more and more difficult. A lot of coaches come into their coaching career and they feel really, really good about their X's and O's knowledge, the technical aspects of the game. And I was very much the same way. That's what I thought coaching was all about. But it's so much more than that. It's about being, especially at the high school level. And you can say the same thing at the college level or even the professional level. It's about being the CEO of your program. Folks, I think I've put together maybe the best thing I've ever done, and that is my third book coming out here this fall, 365 Days of Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. And what I was able to do was to put together 365 separate concepts of what it takes to become a basketball CEO of your program. This is all divided into basically 10 different areas: book studies, coach studies, X's and O's. So you gotta know what the 2-3 zone defense is all about. Zone sets, defensive tenets, whatever that may be. Culture, building a great culture at your program. Your game day execution. What are you doing on a game day on a daily basis when you're going into competitions? Skill development. Personal development, finding time for you, taking a vacation, handling failure, creating your resume, practice, how to build a great practice, how to become a great practice coach, off-season workout ideas, and miscellaneous coaching topics. 365 Days of Hoops has those 10 topics subdivided into 365 different things that you need to do as a basketball coach. At the end of every page, there is space to journal, to write, to X's and O's, everything that you need to do to take that topic, to think about it, and to think about what you are going to do. This is going to be available early this fall. Don't have an exact date yet, but I wanted to put that out there for you coaches so that you know what's coming out here. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you. One thought a day, take 3 to 5 minutes every day to think about it. And by the time you're done with this book, you are going to be really, really be prepared to be a basketball CEO of your program. So keep your eye out on it for 365 Days Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, coming this fall from a pen and a napkin. Jim, what are we going to remember John Thompson for?
You know, I think we've hit upon it several times, Marty. I think he obviously gets remembered, and you're in the Hall of Fame for the wins, the national championships, the conference championships, what he did on the court. I mean, that's, you know, ultimately, you know, it is a basketball podcast, and those wins and losses were important. And he was a trailblazer. You know, you talked about his first African-American coach in the Final Four, first African-American coach to win a national championship. He changed Georgetown University. He was instrumental in getting Georgetown University into the Big East. You referenced kind of some of the similarities between Georgetown and Creighton. We see it firsthand here in Omaha, how Creighton University has changed due to their inclusion in the Big East. So I think all of those things are wonderful. But, you know, I just keep going back to, you know, the transformational aspects of his coaching and the care that he had for his players. And, you know, whether it was the confronting a drug lord who was trying to get involved with some of his more, you know, players with greater potential, the 97% graduation rate, the standing up for not only potential Georgetown players, but kids from all over the country that he felt were unfairly impacted by this Proposition 42. You know, the tributes and the legacy, you know, like I said, I think we would all love to, when our time is done, to have our former players speak about us and the role and impact we had on both their basketball lives and their personal lives, the way so many Georgetown players did about Coach Thompson. And I think at the end of the day, those things certainly outweigh anything on the basketball court or outweigh you know, any mistakes, you know, on a, you know, Olympic basketball roster construction or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I think the basketball stuff is very impressive. And I think it's, you know, it's a coaching podcast, right? So we take the transformational stuff and then, you know, we talked about kind of the comparison you made to the Houston teams of modern day. Can you get your team to be as tough as what those Georgetown teams were on the defensive end? On
buy into that identity.
Yes. And just, you know, like we talked about earlier, I mean, if somebody could say about your team that, hey, they're not going to beat themselves, or they're not going to go away. You're going to have to knock them out. You're going to have to, you know, and credit to Villanova. They threw the perfect game, but it was going to take, you're going to have to play very well most of the time to beat a John Thompson coach Georgetown team. I know towards the end, you know, maybe the wins and losses weren't quite what they were. Yeah, you know, for most of his career, but for most of his career to beat a Georgetown team, they weren't going to beat themselves. You were going to have to match their toughness, their physicality, and play really well. And I think that's the basketball takeaway. And then, you know, like we said, the stuff away from the court, which is, in my opinion, you know, certainly as important for all of us as coaches to take away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, you said a lot of it there, Jim, the tough love for his players, but he always had their back, always defended them as long as they did the right thing. The phrase that we heard a lot as kids, hoya paranoia, you know, John Thompson was very protective of his players. But again, coming from a lot of their socioeconomic backgrounds, he was going to be the guy that was going to protect them and not let them get taken advantage of by again, the hangers-on, the bad influences, that type of a thing. You know, as I remember this, Jim, as I'm sure you do as well, the white towel on his shoulder that he kept on his shoulder the entire time. I did not know this. He put that there for his mom. He, you know, letting his mom know that he was thinking about her while he was coaching. That's why he had the white towel on his shoulder. I did not know that.
I knew he always had a white towel. I did not know the reason behind it.
Yeah. So I think the great thing about Thompson is, you know, it's hard to explain today just how much of the center of the college basketball universe was Georgetown was during the mid to late 1980s. They were akin to Alabama football under the Saban era, or Krzyzewski during the Duke era. This is, you know, this is pre-Coach K taking over, you know, and a lot of that had to do with the media coverage, you know, Big Monday on ESPN. I remember watching, I grew up watching Big East basketball on USA Network back when they called it the USA Network. It's been five different things. I think it's now Paramount is what it is. But I grew up watching Chris Mullin at St. John's, Ewing at Georgetown, Pearl Washington at Syracuse, and all of these different teams. And it's difficult for those that were not there or don't understand the history of the game, just how influential for that 15-year stretch or so, you know, from about the time Patrick Ewing got there to when Allen Iverson left to go to the NBA, for that 15-year stretch or so, Georgetown was one of the top five, if not maybe top three programs in the country for that stretch of time. And now we look at where Georgetown is today, they're struggling to get back into relevance. But that's why when they do have any sort of modicum of success, people talk about it with such reverence because of what Coach Thompson did with those Georgetown teams.
Yep. I mean, you said it. I remember, you know, I'm a little younger, a little less experienced and seasoned than you, Marty.
Yes.
But I think anybody that, you know, was a basketball fan growing up, and, you know, for me, it was really the late 80s and early 90s. We all remember those Big Mondays and Big East basketball. And, you know, John Thompson is certainly synonymous with those. But, yeah, like you said, I think for people that are maybe a little bit younger and see where Georgetown is today, I mean, it was a very different thing back then. They were, as you said, as dominant of a program, we talked about, they were maybe two or three plays away from winning three national championships in 4 years, and they just had an aura about them.
Yes, that's a great way to say it.
I mean, when you play Georgetown, that was a big game.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to beat Georgetown. I mean, there was a real aura about Georgetown in the, you know, the mid to late 80s and into the, like you said, probably the Allen Iverson, you know, the end of his career is when things maybe, you know, the success rate started to go down a little bit.
That was the last great run. Yep. If you want to know more about Coach Thompson, I was telling Jim about this before we got going here. His autobiography came out posthumously. It's called I Came as a Shadow. And my good friend Jeff Ritz let me borrow this. Great book. I highly encourage it. Just if you're a basketball fan, you need to read the story of Coach Thompson talking about his youth growing up poor in Washington, D.C. It's just a great, great read. Coach Simons, before you order Hoops 365, after you've read The Last of the Cowboys, which I appreciate that text that you sent me about the book, Coach.
Yeah, I read it. It was good. It was interesting. That was a good read.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. And I didn't pay Jim for that yet, so... Yes, that's the key word. And we're going to get to that here. So, check out I Came as a Shadow. It's a great, great read. So check that out. Mr. Simons, have you ever heard of the band called Europe?
I'm not familiar with the band called Europe.
Let me get you familiar with them right now.
I'm familiar with the song.
There we go. I wanted to give you the full coaching staff experience here, Jim. So you are the first non-Tony Viss person to be on this to get a trivia question. So are you ready, sir, for...
I am. God, I thought I kind of already aced the trivia section with your questions earlier. So now I got to wrap back up.
This is the formal trivia. You know, there's a difference here. There's a difference. We're a lot more scientific here on the coaching staff than... No, we're not. We're really not. So here's your trivia question, Mr. Simons. When LaSalle beat Bradley in the 1954 NCAA championship game, it took place just south of us, about 3 hours, Kansas City Municipal Auditorium. Kansas City has hosted the Final Four more than any other city in the history of the tournament. My question to you, Mr. Simons, how many times has Kansas City hosted the Final Four?
Oh, well... Gosh, that's a good question. I don't think they've hosted it since 1988, right? When Kansas beat OU in that memorable championship game.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess 9 seems high. But let's go 9.
9 is incorrect. But you get 2 more chances and you are too low.
I'm too low. So I thought 9 seemed high and I'm too low. Okay. Well, let's go 11.
That is incorrect.
Oh boy.
You are too high.
Oh, well, that's going to make it very easy. Even my social studies math can figure that out. So we must be 10 times Kansas City is hosted.
For the third time today, Jim Simons, deep downtown. Yes. And it counts.
Yes, 10 times. And you are correct that the last time that Kansas City hosted the Final Four was 1988 at Kemper Arena. That was Danny and the Miracles defeating the OU, the great, kind of the same thing. Two teams from the same conference played each other. And OU was the better team, and they were familiar with one another. And I think even when Mel Allen watched that game, he said,
how about that?
See, I'm giving you the full treatment here, Jim. I'm giving you everything I got here. So let's talk a little twib here. It's a little bit of a lull, but you know we've got some things going on. Let's talk on the floor here. I talked Jim into talking a little WNBA here. We had the rematch. We just started the second half of the season. We finally had the rematch between the Lynx and the Liberty. Epic five-game series that the Liberty won somewhat controversially in game five last fall. They met up in Minneapolis the other night. The Lynx end up winning 100-93. Now, Breanna Stewart out for the Liberty, a bone bruise. Sounds like it's pretty serious. They think they'll have her back for the playoffs in a few weeks. And, those bone bruises around the knees, that can be a troublesome injury, right, Jim?
Not good. Yeah, especially like you said, when they're talking about hopefully back for the playoffs, that hopefully word always makes you a little bit nervous if you're a Liberty fan or if you're coaching and your athletic trainer gives you a hopefully. You like definitively much better than hopefully.
definitively is much better than hopefully. So, no, it's a great game. You know, probably kind of turning into my favorite player to watch in the W. And I know you don't watch a lot of women's basketball, Jim, but I know you have an appreciation for the game. Nafisa Collier, she is just so good. She can defend, she can score, she screens, she rolls, she shoots, she gets to the free throw line. A great leader. Her and Michaela McBride combined for 54 of their 100 points. It would be a little concerning if you're a Lynx fan that you gave up 93, especially without Stewart play. If Stewart is playing and they still get 93, you need a little bit more of a, you know, okay, that may happen.
Yeah, you may be, because that was at Minneapolis, right? And yeah, so that may, if that rematch materializes in the finals and she is healthy, it may be a little cause for concern that you're playing at home without their best player and one of the best players in the league. And it's obviously a down to the wire game. So that might be the reason for a little concern, or it may just be you're in the middle of the regular season and things will look a little different when the playoffs come too.
Yep. Well, we will see them play each other three times in the next couple of weeks after this. So, stay tuned in and
it'll be interesting. Was that the first game they played without Stewart?
That was the first game.
Because you sometimes see teams, you know, the first game a star or an elite player is out. Sometimes you're able to kind of band together and, find a way to maybe play a little bit above your skis in those situations. But you generally see the longer somebody's out, it becomes more difficult to maintain that level of play.
Yeah. So we'll see how it plays out here. You know, New York has been kind of banged up all year, and then, we'll just see how it goes. So speaking of New York, I know this, and I'm just telling you, Jim, this is the coin of the realm on the coaching staff. This is the currency that we use, and this is something that Mikhail Bridges is going to be able to pick up for you the next time you guys have dinner.
We have the meats.
So, you know, I got a big mushroom or a big roast beef sandwich waiting for you at some point for coming on here today, Jim. And we've got Mikhail Bridges re-signing with the Knicks here, 4 years, $150 million. They're keeping the Villanova core together. You said you're a Knicks fan. I'm just going to let you cook, my friend.
Yeah, I'm a Knicks fan, so that was good news. Not only did they get him re-signed, but they got him re-signed a little bit below, the max that he could have signed for. And I am a Knicks fan, and I've maintained being a Knicks fan for a lot of years of bad basketball before the last couple of years, which has been markedly better. So I think good news both for the player and the franchise. And, I think it does. Everybody kind of talks about the Villanova connection, all that, but I think it does speak something, at least as a Knicks fan, I hope it does, that I think Mikhail is the third player that that has signed with the Knicks for a little bit less than the maximum. Of course, these guys are signing for money that, even a lot less than the maximum that would sound good to two school teachers like you and I.
Well, I mean, you do teach at Westside, so you're used to swimming in this amount of zeros here.
Yeah, that's we're right in that neighborhood. But I do think it certainly says something, hopefully. I certainly don't have any inner workings or knowledge of the inner workings, but says something about the culture and the desire for the team to stay together and the desire for the team to, for the players to help the team from a salary cap standpoint, maybe do a few more things than they otherwise would have been able to do. I think you have to have, a very, very high level degree in economics to understand the salary cap and the second apron and all that stuff. And my degree in social studies is very, very far from knowing much about economics. So I don't pretend to understand it at all. You've got to really be intelligent to understand exactly how the NBA salary cap works. But I do know the fact that those guys, Brunson kind of started it, and then OG Anunoby did the same, that those three guys signing for a little bit less than their maximum value has afforded the club a little bit more, wiggle room or an ability, and some of the other guys are going after. So I think that says something, that the guys really are committed to each other and, trying to put the best team or give the front office the opportunity to put the best team together that they can. And, Bridges was at times, maybe didn't live up to expectations during the regular season. This year, his first year with the Knicks, but I think it was, kind of a feeling out process of new team, new coach. Again, I certainly don't have any inside knowledge. Based on some things I've read, I don't think Mikal Bridges, was too broken up about the fact that the Knicks made a coaching change.
Well, he would make, if he kept playing for Tibbs the next 3-4 years, it would have evened out to about a dollar a minute of game time that he played.
He was playing a lot of minutes. And that's maybe the difference for the NBA coaches than us high school coaches. I've not had very many high school players complain that they were playing too many minutes. But obviously the NBA a little bit different, an 82 game season and a 48 minute game. But I think Bridges was really good at times in the playoffs, especially in the Celtics series. And a couple of my friends who are Celtics fans, I like to remind them the Knicks were still up 3-1 before Tatum got hurt. And Bridges, especially defensively, was really instrumental in that, made a couple of big-time defensive plays late in games one and games two that helped him win. So I think, well, last year may have been a little bit of an acclimation period, he played awful well in the playoffs, and he seemingly, I think thinks that maybe the coaching change will be a good thing for him. But he he's a good player, and I think it helps them collectively to get him locked down, A, and then B, to do it for a little bit less than the max. So hopefully that's a good thing. The Knicks certainly have a window of opportunity here in the East next year with some of the unfortunate injuries that other teams are dealing with.
Well, speaking of windows of opportunities, the Clippers are trying to maximize their window of opportunity. Now, half their team may be collecting Social Security by the time this window is closed here, but and leading
maybe collecting Social Security as the window is opening.
Yes, Chris Paul re-signing here, I think it's a great deal, and I think he's got something to give in the role that they're imagining him for, probably 16 to 20 minutes a night and be a gap guy for James Harden and to fill in that role. Obviously he's one of the best point guards to ever play the game. And it's good to see him. Hopefully I don't think the Clippers are going to win a championship next year, but I would not be surprised if they gave it a run with this veteran squad. And, kind of similar to what Dallas did with Nowitzki and I think it was 2011, just kind of this older group of guys, and they kind of catch that lightning in the bottle. And they got a lot of old guys, but the key is they've got a lot of them that hopefully with that depth of 10 or 11 guys that they can play on a nightly basis, that they're able to balance out their roster and do that. But I think it's good that Chris Paul is going to probably end his career back where he was perhaps at his most influential with the Lob City Clippers.
Well, like you said, a lot of old guys, but a lot of successful, talented old guys. They're probably a team that, if they can get through their 82-game grind of the regular season, relatively intact from a health perspective, with the talent and with the playoff experience that the group has, you know, there'll be somebody that, you know, might be a 4, 5, 6, 7 type seed in the Western Conference playoffs. And you're not going to be real excited about drawing a team with that talent and that experience, assuming they all stay healthy in there. It would be very much, as you like to say, a very seasoned and experienced team, which could pay dividends in the playoffs. And the NBA will, especially the Western Conference, you know, like we referenced, I'm kind of a Knicks fan. I'm glad for next year they'll be hanging out in the East, because the West is
A battle of attrition.
I don't know how you'd handicap 1 through 10 in the West going into next year. It's going to be a wild ride over there. A lot of good teams. The Clippers, if they can stay healthy,
they'll be in the mix.
Yeah, they've made themselves better. There's no doubt about it.
Yep. Jim Simons, head boys basketball coach, Omaha Westside High School, and pinch hitting today. Don't worry, Tony, you're going to be back in the lineup. This is not Wally Pipp here. We're going to have you back. But, Jim, this was great. This was a lot of fun to kind of change it up and still talk about coaching, but then honor the history of the game and to hopefully bring about a lot of different things that coaches can pick up upon in studying some of the coaches that came before us.
You bet. No, I think, like we talked about at the beginning, it's basketball is a game that can be played and coached in a number of different ways. You got to find what works for you and your team. But I think you would be silly not to look back at some of the game's greats and maybe, you know, you can't probably take everything they did and try to be a carbon copy of somebody you're not. But you can certainly take some tidbits and some nuggets from all of these successful coaches. And I think anybody who dives into Coach Thompson and what he did at Georgetown, like I said, there's going to be some things you could take out of it that'll make yourself a better coach, make your program better, and maybe help in that all of us are chasing to try to be as good of a transformational leader as we can. But no, I enjoyed it. I'm sure Tony will be back in the saddle next week, and the pinch hitter will go back to the bench. But I enjoyed it. So, and I think that makes us even. So, I had to bail out on you a couple months ago at the last second. So
it's okay.
I think we're now evened up.
We're all good. We got through it. I knew it was the reason why you bailed was a very, very good reason, and I'll never get upset with a coach who's looking to help out a player. And that's what you're doing.
Yeah, we were doing a little college visit.
Yeah. So absolutely no issues with that, Jim. I still love you, my man.
We're good.
Yeah. So it's been great having Jim on here on the coaching staff here. Tony and I will be back we'll be back next week talking about something. We're not sure yet. I got to wait for Tony to get back from vacation and we'll get it figured out. So, but I really want to thank Jim for coming on here today. And I hope you folks have enjoyed it. Like I said at the beginning here, if you really like this, let me know. If you thought the concept stunk, let me know. But I think we talked about a lot of really, really good things that's going to help coaches get better. And again, I think it's important that you study not just, and I don't want to take anything away from Todd Golden from Florida or, some younger active coach. Jim, I'm getting seasoned and experienced enough. I can't think of younger and active coaches. But it's still important to take a look at the generations before us and John Thompson, as things do happen with history, kind of has gotten lost in that. So I really encourage you to study Coach Thompson, to take a look at him, especially the way that he took care of his players and he tried to take care of them on and especially off the floor. So hope you folks have enjoyed this. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.